This is my fifth and last talk in the series of talks that I have been giving here. And this evening I like to go into this question of developing meditation in our everyday life. Now, in talking about this very important theme, I thought I will try to relate it to the culture here, because I have found over the years, trying to teach meditation in different cultures, that the cultural factor can be extremely important. In a sense, in an absolute sense, the culture is not so important. Because according to Buddhism, whether it is a Western mind, whether it is a Sri Lankan mind, or whether it is a Singaporean mind, suffering would arise in relation to greed, hatred and delusion. And when they are not there, you can experience freedom in whichever culture you live in. But having said that, I have discovered that there are certain cultural aspects which seems to come up in meditation. So therefore I feel that it is sometimes interesting and important to address that issue. Just to give a few examples, when I try to teach meditation to Westerners, I often have to tell them not to try too hard. Because due to cultural factors, they seem to have a tendency to try very hard, goal-oriented. And when I am in Sri Lanka, I have to tell them to try hard, because they are more laid back. So this is how the cultural aspect can come up. Another interesting difference is, I often meet Westerners when they have problems relating to what is happening in meditation. They would invariably relate those problems to what happened in childhood. But I have yet to meet a Sri Lankan who would tell me that the problems they are having are related to what happened in childhood. Now, this difference interested me very much. Not that children in Sri Lanka would not have problems with their parents, but at least the emphasis there is to feel grateful to the parents. So with that connection, with that relationship to parents, they will never feel like blaming the parents for whatever they are going through. And I can never forget when I was in Zimbabwe and Botswana, where I was teaching meditation to black people. I had a very interesting experience. I discovered that the blacks are generally anchored in their body. Being aware of the body seems to come to them very naturally. And they have also less concepts in their mind, very uncomplicated minds they have. So in one meditation course, a black person said, "Yes, you want to be with the breath? Yes, I am with the breath. So what's the problem? What is next?" Usually meditators have problems with this technique of focusing on breathing. For him, it was so simple. He had no problems. For the first time, I was surprised with that response. So what's the problem? I am with the breath. So what comes next? Now, since coming here, I have been interested in the culture here, in the Singaporean culture, in the Chinese culture. So I like to share with you some aspects of this culture in a very tentative way, because I can't claim that I have learned everything about the culture. So I like to emphasize that my conclusions are tentative. So I would like to really learn from your experience in relation to this area, and to see how working in this culture, meditation can be applied in some cultural areas. One aspect that I discovered here is that people like authority very much. You get the same thing in Sri Lanka. They don't question authority. So when a monk would give a sermon, no questions. After the sermon, they merely said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. When I try to have discussions with Sri Lankans, I would try to stimulate them to ask questions. It's not difficult, it's extremely difficult, because they don't want to question authority. They accept whatever teachings is in a very in an authoritative way. They don't question the tradition. Now I must suggest that this is in a way extremely unfortunate, because the spirit of the Dhamma is questioning. There is no authority in the Dhamma. The Buddha said not to even accept him on authority. Only when you can experience what he says, then accept. So there is really no blind belief in Buddhism. And this aspect of authority comes up in different ways when I was working with meditators. So they would say, now where exactly do I have my right hand? Do I always keep the right hand over the left hand? Then if they have a pain, they would tell me, I am having this pain. Is it normal that I have this pain? And if I say yes, that's accepted without any question. No problem if I say yes. So what should be attempted in meditation is not to accept authority, to explore, to investigate, to find out yourself. Not to even accept what the Buddha has said. So if you are having anger, if you are having fear, if you are having sadness, find out what is wrong with them. What is wrong with anger? What does anger really do to you? So this is the spirit of the Dhamma, free inquiry. And when I teach the Dhamma to young people in Sri Lanka, school children, I encourage them to question. Don't accept what I say. I often tell them that it is through questioning that you can make discoveries. I would tell them that Newton made that profound discovery by asking a simple question, why does apple fall? And I would tell them that Prince Siddhartha became a Buddha by asking simple questions, what is the cause of sickness? Why do people die? Why do people grow old? When he saw them, when these questions arose in his mind, he wanted to find the answer to them. So in a sense, meditation can be seen as asking questions. Why do I get angry? What are concepts? Why do I have fear? How does pain come? How does sadness come? So you have to be daring and raise these questions and then find answers for yourself. So the problem is, when you accept authority, you don't become self-reliant. You want to have props that are there externally, and you just accept them. So whereas in meditation, whereas in Dhamma, what is emphasized is self-reliance, self-effort. to see for yourself very clearly, very sharply, how you create your own suffering, and through that realization to find a way out. So in this exercise, in this exploration, in a sense there is no place for authority. So this is the first point I like to make. Another aspect related to authority is the question of obedience. I think this is another aspect which is emphasized very much. Obedience to parents, parental authority. Now it is something beautiful to have that. In fact, in Sri Lanka, this is emphasized very much. But then here again, do we blindly follow the parents just because you have to be obedient to them? Are they always right? Shouldn't you ask questions and clarify from them why they are behaving in a particular way or why they are giving instructions to them? Sometimes when I work with children, they say very amusing things about their parents. They would say the parents would tell the children not to tell lies, but then on certain occasions when a neighbor comes, here the mother would tell the daughter, please tell the neighbor that I am sleeping. In the Dhamma, what is emphasized is spiritual relationship. So if the relationship between parents and children can be such a relationship, then rather than this blind obedience and accepting authority, the relationship is based on friendliness. It's a beautiful relationship to have in any type of relationship, whether it's the relationship between husband and wife, parents and children. So that in that type of relationship, you explore together. You learn from each other. And you have complete trust and understanding among the members of the family, rather than having this kind of obedience, which is called filial piety. Another interesting thing that I discovered here, which I have been often referring to, is loss of face. Loss of face. Now, what does this indicate? What does this imply? I think it has very interesting aspects. One thing, loss of face implies the fear of making mistakes. Fear of making mistakes. So that your whole effort is to avoid mistakes and to act as if you are completely perfect. So when such people take to meditation, what happens? They want to be the perfect meditator. And when they want to be the perfect meditator, they are bound to have problems. So that what is presented in the Dhamma is to be open to our humanness, to be open to our imperfections, to make them the objects of meditation, to learn from them. Otherwise, with this effort not to lose face, what is the result? You can suppress, push away, deny this aspect of infallibility, this aspect of the humanness, and then present the image to others, which is in a way not something natural, which is contrived. There's an element of pretension in that kind of behavior, where you impose this image of doing things correctly, doing things perfectly, fearing to make any mistakes, fearing to be vulnerable. And the consequence is, if there is a situation where there is loss of faith, where you think you have failed, this can create considerable suffering. In fact, in Japan, where this loss of faith is a pronounced one, people commit suicide. One reason why the rate of suicide is high in Japan may be related to this idea of loss of faith, so that they can't stand it. In Sri Lanka, it's the same thing. It's very interesting, in some cultures the emphasis is on guilt. I like to suggest that those who have worked on this area take up the position that in the West the primary emotion is guilt, because the emphasis is on the individual. Now in cultures where the emphasis is on the group, like Asian culture, generally speaking, the emphasis is on shame, because what is more important is the group, the people around you. So you make considerable effort not to lose face in the light of the people around you. This is where, if such a thing were to happen, you feel ashamed, you feel ridiculed. I like to suggest sometimes, maybe in an audience, you don't like to ask a question, because you might think maybe it's a foolish question, maybe it is a silly question, because you want to always ask perfect questions, impressive questions. I can never forget in one of the retreats I gave in an Asian country. Sometimes in these retreats I mention stories from spiritual traditions. And then after relating these stories, I told the people who were taking part in it, please mention any stories that you have heard or any personal experience you had. It's just one or two people who told any stories. But when I met them individually, they told me, I also knew some stories, but I didn't know whether it was the perfect story. So unless you know that it is going to be the perfect story or the perfect question, you don't open your mouth. Why? Loss of face. People will be ridiculed. So see the tension that it creates, that you have a particular image of yourself and you want to project that image to your others. So maybe you are dressing in a particular way, you have ornaments in a many way, so this can take many forms. And this can create, as I said, a lot of tension. There is no naturalness, there is no spontaneity. All the time you are trying to maintain your image. All the time you are afraid that your image will be shaken, that your image will be affected. What a lot of suffering. And then when people accept your image, the image that you have come to, you are very happy with them, you are very pleased with them. But if some group, if some people were to reject that image, you feel frustrated. This loss of faith can also take another dimension. It also means that you like to conform with others. You have to agree with others. You have to belong to the group. Then that gives a sense of security. But this is a false kind of security. So here again, what is conformity? If you consider some of the pioneers, religious leaders, were they conformists? Was Prince Siddhartha a conformist? So not to conform needs a lot of courage. You have to be vulnerable. You have to be open to insecurity. So in the practice of the Dhamma, in practice of meditation, you have to let go of the image that you are holding on to and the image that you are trying to present to the other person. At least to see how this idea of images would arise and how trying to maintain this image that you are holding on to, how it creates suffering and how our likes and dislikes would arise in maintaining these images. This is a very important aspect that one has to see in relationships, in one's practice. In this connection, I often use a metaphor. What happens with these images, models, is that we put ourselves on a pedestal. I am like this. And then what happens? We fall from the pedestal that you have placed yourself in. And that is how we are hurt. That is how we suffer from guilt. And then we do the same thing in relation to other people. We put other people on pedestals. And these based on models, images. And these models and images are based on the culture. So here again, this is how shame would arise. This is how guilt would arise. And my guess is, in this culture, I have been encountering both shame and guilt. I like to hear some comments on that. The people I have been working with, I realized, suffer both from guilt and shame. So it shows that this can generate considerable suffering. Comparing yourself with others, and if you see certain things which are not there in others, suffering, hurt. Another aspect that I have discovered working with meditators here during this short period is, unlike the black people I met, I have the impression that people are not anchored in their body. This becomes very clear the way you breathe. Last week, just to give an example, I worked with a few people who had problems. Some psychological problems, some physical pain. And I discovered that every one of them, the breathing was not smooth, that it was shallow. And perhaps this is also related to not being open to feelings. So perhaps, I am not sure, in this culture, and as it is in the case of Asian cultures, there may be a lot of control and repression. And when there is a lot of control and repression, this is bound to affect our bodies. In fact, when I work with meditators, I have discovered that they have tensions in the body when they are meditating. And sometimes these tensions in the body can be due to certain blocks in the body. So I have discovered that sometimes just being aware of them is not helpful. I have to work with a very long-standing meditator. He has been, in fact, a pioneer in Singapore as a meditator. And then he was carrying pain in the stomach. And then when I worked with him, it dawned on him that pain was related to what happened in childhood. So it seems that this is an important area to explore in the context of meditation. So it is very interesting that in the main text, which spells out the development of awareness and mindfulness, it starts with your body and feelings. So maybe with this emphasis of perhaps the intellect, maybe you are too much in the head and much less in the body. This is another guess that I have. So therefore, it is very, very important to be anchored in the body, to be conscious of the body, to discover the body, to feel the body, learn to listen to the body. Another aspect that I discovered in this culture is the question of money. I am not surprised that money is offered to gods here. Even this time I had a couple of telephone calls. What are your charges, please? This is the first time that I have been ever asked about the charges. First time in any country where I have been asked about the charges. During my first visit, I had someone visiting me a few occasions. Every time he came to see me, he had to leave some money. I had to tell him on the second or the third occasion, please take the money away. Our relationship is not based on money. Our relationship is not based on money. And in relation to money, again, perhaps this can create problems. The emphasis on materialism, where accumulation of money becomes so important that the human factor is completely lost in the process. So you start to worship money. And then, if you try to explore this in the context of meditation, what you discover is a lack, something that is lacking in you, and to cover this lack, money can come as a substitute. So however much money you have, you'll be always discontent because that lack is still there. So you have to trace the root cause for this lack, this feeling of inadequacy. In whatever experiences you have, even if you have meditative experiences, it's not good enough. It has to be always different from what you are experiencing. Another aspect of worshipping money, placing a lot of importance on money, is what are called status symbols. So what are the status symbols here? May I know the status symbols here? Not any car, it has to be a Benz, I think. BMW. In Sri Lanka, you know what the status symbol is? A washing machine. A washing machine is a status symbol. So what does the status symbol indicate? Again, accepting your image. So when you are concerned in your image, to go back to the point that I mentioned, what happens is you are making such a lot of effort to please other people. Because you have become so dependent on what others think of you, your whole life revolves on what others are thinking. So your whole life revolves around, as I said, pleasing other people, getting approval from other people. This is again due to a lack. And the lack is that, as I often say, you have not made friends with yourself. So if you can see yourself as your best friend, if you can be completely self-contained within oneself, then the idea of the loss of face doesn't arise. Then the idea of pleasing others does not arise. You see how these aspects will affect you in your meditation, in your everyday life. This can create a lot of suffering, a lot of hurt. All the time you are comparing yourself with others, competing with status symbols. I met a person who was unhappy because he was doing his best to please others, and the more he tried, the more he failed. So I had to suggest to him, see the basis of it. See what you are doing. See what you are trying to cover. So these are insights that we have to develop. This is why yesterday after my talk, I emphasized the importance of reflection. So this is where in everyday life you can reflect on these things. What am I doing in life? Why am I trying to get this status symbols, trying to impress other people? Where is it going to lead me? Am I happy in this process? This is meditation. It's not only sitting and focusing on breathing. It's how you relate to other people, how you relate to possessions. Another aspect that I encountered here, which is also there in other cultures, is to be comfortable with what is familiar. What is unfamiliar is not very comfortable. What is known gives you a sense of security. But what is unknown, the unknown always generates fear. It was interesting for me. I was taken to a dinner with members of the committee to an Indian restaurant. For the first time, some of them were eating something unfamiliar. Indian food. It was so unfamiliar to some of them. And we were joking now. Who are the people who will come back? Some were definite that they are not going to come back. They have been used to a particular type of food. They are used to a particular type of lifestyle. So when that changes, when it is not familiar, they are not happy. They are unhappy. So the real practice is to see how dependent we are on certain things. When we take away these dependencies, how do you relate to it? So in the meditation center I live in, there is no place for that. You are most of the time exposed to unfamiliar things, starting from leeches to other situations. The usual things that people are dependent on, newspapers, radio, our toys. In fact, when Sri Lankans come there, after some time they feel bored. No newspapers to read, no newspapers to escape. They are so addicted to news. One day without news, they feel that something is missing in them. So you see, as human beings, how dependent we have become on things. You are so dependent on electricity. In our center, there is no electricity. People say, there is no electricity, there is no hot water. So if you are really serious about your practice, this is what you have to go through. See how you relate to such situations. So, can we be open to these unfamiliar situations? And how far can we flow with them? Can we overcome the fears that we have to the unknown? I like to suggest that the fear to the unknown may be, I am sure, emerging in the fear of death. In fact, when we did that workshop on death, I think I was able to guess that the theme of death is not something popular. Am I right in saying that? So this confirms, because death is something unknown. So what is unknown can be fearful, so don't talk about it. Why should we talk about these morbid, unpleasant things? So that when someone dies, naturally there is fear in relation to what happens after death. And if you know you are going to die, how would you face that situation of death? Because you have never addressed that issue. Without thinking of death, you have created a false sense of security. So if you are really earnest about the practice, you have to start working with the known, and to realize what is unknown is really related to the known. So sometimes fear is not related to the known, to the unknown. It depends on how you are relating to the known. I'll give an example. I was so inspired by a woman I met in Europe in the late 80s. And I brought up the question of death. She said, I am not afraid of death. So I asked her, now, do you know what is going to happen after death? I don't know, but I don't have fear. You see, it's not the question of unknown. She didn't know what will happen, but still, as she has worked with fear and she has overcome fear, she had no problem with the unknown. A few suggestions about the individual practice, again related to the culture. Today I was meeting a meditator, and I hear this story very often. In fact, in the library I heard the same thing. I am not making any progress in meditation. And this girl who came to see me this morning told me that she had gone to Malaysia for a retreat. And there the talk is that Singaporeans are not successful in meditation. And last time I was here, I met casualties, meditation casualties, because they were trying too hard and due to different reasons, they had physical problems, they had psychological problems. Now what I like to suggest is, when you are meditating, please don't have expectations of what should happen or what shouldn't happen. It's okay to have a kind of goal. The metaphor that I use is, it's like climbing a mountain and the goal is to reach the top. But if you are preoccupied and concerned only with the top, then you miss what's happening when you are climbing that hill. It's more fun, the adventures you have in the process of climbing. So I like to suggest, please see meditation as not ending something, not the goal. Here again, maybe in this culture, it is goal-oriented. It's always doing something. Achieving, wanting. So if you can see whatever is happening in your practice as something interesting, not the end result. So if you are working with anger, if you are working with fear, don't, or pain, don't work with those things in order to get rid of them, but see the working of them is also as something interesting. If your mind is not calm, don't imagine a situation where your mind will be calm in the future. At the moment your mind is not calm, so work with that factual situation. Find it interesting, see it as a learning experience. So it's not ending things, but what you are confronting with, what you are working with, whatever the problem is, to develop a taste for it. In this connection, I think this idea of playfulness, I don't think is emphasized in this culture, because to be playful, you have to be really vulnerable. If you are really concerned with losing face, you can't be playing. So if you can see working with these situations as a play, then there is already a lightness to it, there is already a joy in it, not the ending of it, not the progress. Not what comes after. So having said that, I think I like to pause and I like to hear from you I like to hear any criticisms about what I said. So please don't fear our loss of peace. And please don't fear asking me questions, questioning my authority and saying, this is another thing I discovered. People ask questions, and if I say something, I can see sometimes they don't agree, but they dare say I disagree. Why not say that? Why not be honest? This is another aspect in relationships. Even with your parents, I mean, can't you be honest with what you are experiencing? So this is a beautiful way to relate to others around you, to just honestly say what you feel about it. It's not a case of always pleasing someone. So I'll be very, very happy if someone were to disagree with me, because this would be a learning experience for me. And asking questions, I like to share an experience with you. When I had to teach meditation and Buddhism to American students, it was such a stimulating thing, because they didn't spare me. They did not accept anything on authority. They would question anything. I remember in one university, one of the students asked me, please tell us what happens to you when you are meditating. First time someone asked me. So this should be the spirit of inquiry. If you want to learn, you have to have that spirit. So please ask any questions. Please offer any comments on what I have been saying about the question of the culture and meditation in everyday life. Thank you very much. Nothing special. I have thoughts coming and passing away. I hear sounds. I feel sensations. So the technique that I practice mostly is not focusing on breathing, but a technique called undirected meditation, where there is no object. So I just try to be aware of whatever that is happening. No expectation, no model of what should happen or what shouldn't happen. And whether I am sitting in this posture, or having lunch, or traveling in a bus, there's no difference, because I try to just find out now what is happening, being aware, what are the thoughts that are arising, what are the emotions that are there in the mind. While speaking, I try to see what is happening in my mind. So my meditation is not confined to a particular posture, it's just learning, finding out, of being conscious of what is happening. Is there suffering? Is there no suffering? Just that. Any other questions? Even if you have any personal questions, please ask. If you have such questions, you are welcome to ask me. Yes, very good, very good. One toy I have is books. You know why? Because I was a librarian. And as a librarian, I read very much on Buddhism, other religions, philosophy, psychology. Now my reading is confined mostly to Buddhism, generally speaking. When I am in the center in Nilambe, I don't have time to read, but because I follow a schedule. But when I am in Kandy and when I am traveling, I play with these toys. So that's my toy. Anything else?
In your university, do you have any experience of being badly treated?
Being badly treated? Yes, just one thing that comes to my mind is that I was traveling in Switzerland, from Switzerland to Austria. And in Zurich, I lost my passport, and all the money was stolen in the Zurich station. And the train was traveling, and I realized it's gone. So when it came to the border of Austria, policeman came. Passport, passport. No passport. So it's very interesting. In a foreign country, if you don't have a passport, you are treated as a criminal. So it was very interesting practice for me, the so-called meditation teacher, people who respect and who are very friendly to me, kind to me, here for the first time you are treated as a criminal. So it was very good practice to see how I was relating to it. So I was treated very badly by it, because especially in European countries, my complexion can arouse a lot of suspicion. And when I say no passport, they don't believe it. But just to cut a long story short, afterwards I reflected on that. And when I reflected on this, this is what I realized. That in life you can lose anything. Whatever we own, our status symbols, our possessions, whatever. One thing that one cannot lose is understanding and insight. This was a very valuable lesson for me. Sorry? At the moment when I realized that my passport and my money was lost, I felt anxious, I felt concerned, I didn't know what was happening. And then after some time I recovered. And after I recovered, one of the reflections that came to my mind was this. Then I also had another reflection. I said, what is the worst thing that is going to happen to me? I have lost everything. Now what is the worst thing that is going to happen to me? It's possible that I'll be caught and I'll be sent back to Sri Lanka. So what? So this is a very good exercise in any situation, try to reflect the worst thing that might happen. And you might think that the worst thing is not so bad after all. Sorry? Yes, my pride, my ego was hurt. Certainly, I saw a difference, but again I try to see it. As I said, why am I suffering? My image, my model. Other people should treat me. Immediately I could able to see it. This is the practice. In such situations, this is a very good practice. Any situation you are suffering, just find out what is the model, what is the image that you are holding on to, which is going against now. And then you will realize it's always some idea that you are having of how things should be. So when you see that, to a great extent you can recover from that. Very good practice. Anything else, please? Yes? I can relate to that very much. This is a very important question, because in relation to pain, it's such an intimate experience, such an intense experience, that at that moment, to say that there is only pain is not possible. But still, I must suggest that one can work with that. In fact, there are instances, there are stories, where people have become enlightened, where people have had breakthroughs, just working with pain, where my pain becomes their pain. I will cite a couple of situations. I used to work with terminally ill cancer patients. And you can imagine the physical pain that they experience. So I would go there and I would teach them meditation, which will help them to work with pain. So I tell them, make pain the object of meditation. I still remember one woman telling me, the pain is there, but I am not there. So it shows that you can have that experience, at least as a glimpse, if you can make that the object of meditation. Then I like to say something else, how someone spoke about pain again after a retreat. She said that in a very most compassionate way, she said when she was sitting, pain came. And then what she did was she spoke to the pain. She said, "I know, pain, that everyone in this world doesn't like you. So I feel really sorry for you, pain. I feel really compassionate towards you, my dear pain." And the way she said that, it touched everyone, it moved everyone. So here again, what can be attempted is, this is why I emphasize meditation of loving kindness. In any unpleasant experience, if you can have a little space to have compassion for that experience, to make friends with that situation. This reminds me, you might have heard of Ram Dass. He was a professor of psychology at Harvard, and he left the job, or he had to leave the job, and he took to spiritual life. He came to India and then practiced spirituality. Very recently he had said, "I have been leading a spiritual life for the last 20 or 25 years. So he asked himself the question, "Now what has really happened to me during the last 25 years? Has anything changed in me?" He gave a beautiful answer. "I am the same old neurotic, but the only difference is I am now more friendly with my neurosis." And this is an important breakthrough. If you can make reference with such a situation, then whether it is there or whether it's not there makes no difference.
But the uncertainty is there, or you say, be open to uncertainty. And that really
makes it work. Pessimism is again an attitude to life, attitude to situations. There's a story of someone, a boy, who was carrying milk, and then halfway through the boy for some reason or other loses half the bottle that he was carrying. So he's left with only half a bottle, but he started having a full bottle. Now someone who is so involved in being negative, in being pessimistic, can be very unhappy about the milk that has been lost. But someone who can be optimistic can be very happy that at least there is half a bottle of milk. So it's again, it's not what is happening, but how you are relating to it. And how you are relating to things brings up whether you are pessimistic or optimistic. It's not the event, but how you relate to it. It's again related to meditation. It's not what is happening. It's not the experience, but how we are related to it. Yeah, I have heard this before. Why do some people consider Buddhism as pessimistic? I think sometimes it has a good reason. Because some Buddhists, or most Buddhists, I wouldn't say most Buddhists, but there are Buddhists who are only stuck with the First Noble Truth. I often mention this in Sri Lanka because for some reason I was speaking about the culture. For some reason there is such an emphasis on dukkha, 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 suffering, suffering, suffering. So it is not surprising that some people can see Buddhism as pessimistic. I often tell them that this is only the First Noble Truth. What about the Second Noble Truth? What about the Third Noble Truth? In fact, one of my friends did a thesis on joy in Buddhism. So we did it together, and we were so amazed about the references to joy. So this is an area that is very much neglected. In fact, in the library, I made a few remarks about the importance of joy, the importance of lightness. There are two models. There is one model where meditators, spiritual people, are trying to overcome suffering with suffering. No gain without pain. No pain, no gain. and it's very unfortunate when you meet such meditators. Then there's another model. In fact, in the Dhammapada, I came across this poem that you can overcome suffering with joy. So it's again another model where the emphasis is more on joy, the emphasis is more on lightness, the emphasis is more on playfulness. So you can choose. So going back to Malini's remark, certainly this aspect of suffering and dukkha is emphasized so much, so that it's not surprising that sometimes Buddhism is associated only with pessimism.
To laugh your way to enlightenment.
Beautiful. Wonderful. I emphasize humor very much. I don't know in this culture where there is a humor. I'm not so sure. Especially the humor where you can laugh at yourself. Because if you can laugh at yourself, then when you lose face, if you can laugh at yourself, this is wonderful, this is beautiful, then you don't suffer. There is a very perceptive Buddhist monk in Sri Lanka, you might know his name, Bhikkhu Jnanananda. Once having a discussion with him, he is the author of Concept and Reality in Early Buddhism, a classic, Magic of the Mind, wonderful book. Once discussing, we were discussing, he told me, I see this world as a joke. It's a bad joke sometimes. Certainly, if someone has cancer, it's a bad joke. But he said, it's still a joke. But the problem is we take this joke so seriously. This is the problem. I like to relate stories, so I like to relate a story from the Tibetan tradition to show how what John said, how humor can lead to liberation. So in this story, there was this very serious practitioner doing his practice all by himself on a mountain top. And there was a couple in the village, husband and wife, who would look after the requirements of this meditator. So one day the husband went to visit him, the wife went to visit him, and told him, well, my husband will come to see you in the evening. So when he heard the news and when the woman left, he noticed that his room was very shabby and untidy, maybe like my room. Malini saw my room in Kandy. So, as a good meditator, he tried to tidy the place, tidy the room. But then while tidying it and after he finished, he tried to reflect on it. Now, why did I do this? Then he realized, it is loss of face. It is time to impose a particular image on the person who is coming. So, when he realized that, he made the room into a worse mess. So it was in a worse condition. So the visitor comes in the evening and he tells him what happened. He shows the room and he starts to laugh. And as the story goes, when he was laughing, he became liberated. He was laughing at himself. He was laughing at the absurdity of the situation. So to have this kind of humor, to have this kind of lightness, you cannot be very concerned about the image. So I like to suggest that those who suffer from loss of face in that situation, if you can laugh at yourself, because what are you trying to do? Try to impress other people. See the utter absurdity of it. This would be a beautiful way to relate to the spiritual practice. And this can eventually lead you to a experiencing of joy and lightness and seeing life as a bad joke. It's a nice way of relating to people, relating to this situation.
How much can yoga influence or help us in doing meditation?
Yes, good question, useful question. As I said earlier, there are people who are alienated from their own bodies. They are strangers in their own body. And as I often say, we carry our history in our body. In fact, they have done some research in Switzerland where they say that what happens to an infant in childhood, the body, can affect the person subsequently. So what I have discovered is whatever experiences we have, we seem to be embedded in the body. So therefore, it is extremely important to develop this relationship with the body, to be open to feelings, to be conscious of the body, as I was saying earlier, to listen to the body, to discover the body, to develop this sensitivity to the body. So if you can do yoga or body work, whatever you like to call it, in that context, certainly it becomes a meditation. Certainly it becomes a meditation. So in our center in Sri Lanka, we have yoga in the morning and yoga in the afternoon. In the weekend retreat I gave, most of the people I spoke to, they found the yoga and the body work useful. So it's certainly very much related to the practice. But you should not be too preoccupied with the postures, otherwise it becomes another trap. So you are only concerned with doing postures in a particular way, but you have to use it in a meaningful way where you see it only in the context of meditation, awareness, friendliness, listening, discovering and so on, and working through the blocks that you have in the body. I think this brings up an important question where your morality is based on fear. Where your morality is based on fear. So real morality is, if it is based on fear, it is imposed from the other, it's imposed from outside. So when those safeguards are not there, what happens to your morality? This is the important question that you have to ask yourself. So real morality comes not through fear but through understanding. Real morality comes not from external equation but comes from within. And this kind of morality is related to meditation. And in this connection, I often speak about morality, where this kind of moral life gives rise to bliss. There's a very beautiful Pali word, anavajja sukha, sukha that comes from blamelessness. So the whole idea of morality is sukha, bliss and joy. But this kind of morality, how can there be joy and bliss arising from that kind of morality which is based on fear? Yeah, please. I think I will try to come in about 2 years' time. Yeah. Because next year I hope to. I have got an invitation to visit Europe. So maybe in about 2 years or 3 years' time, I'll certainly like to come back because I have made a lot of friends, and whenever I come, I meet old friends and make new ones. And I also find that people are really motivated in the practice in your own way. So it has been really extremely pleasant for me to have stayed here for some weeks. And I like to take this opportunity to thank the BDMS for allowing that. And I must say that I have been really looked after very well. Sometimes I felt that I have been pampered and spoiled. And now I have to prepare my mind. to go back to a very austere life. In Sri Lanka, sometimes I had to travel in crowded buses where I had to stand. Yeah, it's a very good practice when you are pushed and elbowed. And here I am always taken in luxurious cars. And even they are very concerned, are you comfortable? Can I adjust the seat? So I laugh to myself about this. And the food, in Sri Lanka, the food is very simple because it's a very poor country. And in the center, it's even much poorer. The food that is served is very, very simple. And here, you have always choices. In the retreat, I was amazed. What do you want? Ovaltine, Milo, tea, coffee? Just for the weekend, so many choices. In the center, the choice is very simple. Water or tea, mostly water. There is no electricity. So here, it has been a very luxurious and an extravagant life for me. And I must say that I have been at the receiving end of lot of affection, lot of concern and care for others. So it has been very nice, and I have been very, I must express my gratitude for whatever that has happened. So once again, I like to thank everyone and thank especially those who have taken care of me. And as this is my last talk, as a final message, I like to tell you, please see the importance of meditation. Sometimes I say that this is the most meaningful thing in this meaningless world. If we can reflect on this, see the things that we do to safeguard our physical health. What are the things you do? So many things that you do to prevent illnesses. I know that there is such a lot of emphasis on the health and other things. But what do we do to safeguard our mental health? What do we do to safeguard our mental sanity? So this is meditation, a way to maintain mental health, a way to maintain mental sanity. So while emphasizing the importance of taking the medicine, while saying that, while emphasizing that, I like to conclude my series of talks by wishing you peace, friendliness, gentleness, and as I said, more and more discoveries, more and more questions about life, and then finding the medicine for the sickness that we create ourselves. Thank you very much. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Katrin Samaratana. For the last three weeks, we've had the pleasure of your teaching, which is very down to earth. And I'm sure many of us have benefited from your presence here. As a token of our society's appreciation, I would like to present you a little something so that you can have your toys. Thank you. Friends, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to also show your appreciation after we have finished this. Thank you. Last page of the Durga Puja. Please reflect on this before we chant. Mind is the forerunner of all states. Mind is chief. Mind made a day. If one speaks or acts with wicked mind, because of that, suffering follows one, even as the wheel follows the roof of the drought ox. Mind is the forerunner of all states. Mind is chief. Mind made a day. If one speaks or acts with pure mind, because of that, happiness follows one, even as one's shadow that never parts. Manopumbangamada มโนเศรษฐามโนมายามนัสสะเชปะดุเตนะวาสัตถิวาคโรติวาตัตโตนันตุกัมมันเวติจากังวาวัตตุปะดังมโนปุมปังกมาดามามโนเศรษฐามโนมายามนัสสะเชปัสสันนินะวาสัตถิวาคโรติวาตัตโตนันสุกามันเวติจายาวารันนปายินีตัตโตนันสุกามันเวติจายาวารันนปายินีตัตโตนันสุกามันเวติจายาวะอันนาปายนิสาดุสา